What a joy to meet this man again. He was my pastor years ago in Western Canada. Yeah, I was born in Canada. Prince Edward Island, where the Anne of Green Gables stories were written. Any of you have read about them? As a boy, I went to a one-room country school, just like Anne and Gilbert. Probably had a crush on a girl like Anne. But I hope I wasn't bold enough to dip her pigtails in the inkwell, like Gilbert did with Anne's. And then lived in Western Canada, and that's where Carol and I met Lee and Irene so many years ago. Well, you've heard me introduced, and this speaker begins his message drawing your attention to the most momentous introduction in history. It's found in John chapter 1, verse 19. John the Baptist, privileged to introduce Jesus among the Jewish people, used the world's primary metaphor, saying, "Behold the Lamb of God, who does what?" Say it with me, please. "Who takes away the sin of the world." Think of the impact of that metaphor upon people who spoke the Hebrew language, people who had been practicing animal sacrifice for centuries, each animal sacrifice illustrating the need of an atonement for human sin, whereby God, who is infinitely holy, could genuinely forgive people worthy of punishment without compromising his holiness in the act of forgiving the guilty. Those who sacrificed those animals may have thought that it was that shed animal blood that was atoning for their sin. Was it really? We learn in the Epistle to the Hebrews, the blood of bulls and goats does not put away sin. But that does not mean that all those animal sacrifices were offered in vain. That practice served as a kind of compass, a cultural compass, just as physical compasses from any place on earth have little magnetic arrows. When those little arrows are loosened on their pivots, they swing around and then settle down and point in which direction? Some of you said north. Actually, it's magnetic north. And guess where the magnetic north pole of the world is? In northern Canada, the land of my birth. Every compass on earth points to the land of my birth. So just as all physical compasses have arrows that point to just that one place, God has ordained another kind of compass designed not to point to one place, but to point instead to one person. And that one and only one person is Jesus, the most magnetic personality in the universe. Well, that's one example of an Old Testament cultural compass, animal sacrifice, identified by John the Baptist as pointing forward in time to Jesus, later to be revealed as the Lamb of God. Turn another page in the Gospel of John. You're in chapter 3. Notice what Jesus himself said to Nicodemus in verse 14. He said, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up." That may not have meant very much to Nicodemus at the time. He knew about that account from the Exodus story. But how did it relate to the Son of Man being lifted up? Fast forward about 3 years. Nicodemus was an eyewitness of the crucifixion. Imagine how it must have come back to him when he saw Jesus hanging from the nails on the cross. In John chapter 6, Jesus made reference to the provision of the manna for the children of Israel during their wilderness wanderings. And on that basis said, "Moses gave you not the true bread from heaven. The true bread from heaven is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And then Jesus identified himself as that bread of life. Read on through the New Testament. You'll find many more instances where New Testament writers identify something from the Old Testament background of the Jewish people as anticipating, foreshadowing one aspect or another of redemption later to be brought into the world with the advent of our Lord. I'm sure you'll agree with me, it was good of God to give the Jewish people all those foreshadowings of the Savior. But now I invite you to ponder a major question with me. The question is, What about the rest of the human race? Did God take care to give only one small percentage of mankind foreshadowings of the Redeemer and leave the rest of us without that providence? Down through the centuries, those of us who have been trained to be frontier crossers with the gospel, those of us who have been encouraged to go out into regions of the world where the message had never been proclaimed and learn languages in which it had never been expressed, have not been encouraged by our instructors to expect to find Gentile cultural compasses waiting out there on the other side of those faraway frontiers to help us fulfill our mission and make the meaning of the gospel of Jesus Christ poignantly clear to men and women, even people hearing it for the very first time. Apparently, our instructors didn't think God went to that much trouble. In spite of the fact they didn't teach us to anticipate finding such things, guess what we have been finding and making good use of down through the centuries? Gentile cultural compasses. And often when we frontier crossers came back home for a furlough, we didn't even bother to tell our instructors about the amazing things we found out there. We just left them in the dark. Guess we thought it might confuse them, might not fit into their systematic theology. But would you like me to share some secrets with you from the other side of those frontiers this evening? You really want me to? I just love it when people really want me to tell them what I really want to tell them. All right, I'm taking you back to the 1790s. William Carey arrived in India with his wife Dorothy and were in for some severe culture shock. Hadn't been in India very long when they heard a woman screaming out in the street. William rushed out to see. Why was she screaming? Was she in danger? He saw she was indeed. Her husband had died. The family had placed the husband's body on a pile of firewood. They were about to cremate his body. But they were binding his widow and placing her on that pile of firewood beside the corpse of her husband. William realized with horror she was about to be consumed in flame, burned alive. He was encountering a custom called sati, which meant when a Hindu man died, his widow had to show what was defined as due respect for her departed husband by being burned alive in the same flames that cremated his body. It didn't matter if the widow was decades younger than her deceased husband or if she was the mother of little children that needed her care. And William tried to rescue her, but the crowd kept him back. He appealed to the British colonial authorities of the British East India Company, saying, "You have the power to make this cruel custom called sati illegal. Why haven't you done it?" And they said, "William Carey, our concern is to maintain the steady cash flow of profits for the mother country, England. That is our priority. And we warn you, if you dare to preach against Hindu customs and anger them so they'll refuse to work for us, we will throw you in jail." William Carey shared his problem with his fellow Britishers, with some Danish friends of his in a Danish enclave in India called Serampore. And he said, "They're going to throw me in jail if I preach against things like that, but I feel I have to." And the Dane said, "Guess what, William? We can solve this problem for you." "What? How can you Danes solve my problem with my fellow Britishers?" "Well, it's very simple," they said. "Great Britain and Denmark have a treaty. So we're going to make you a citizen of Denmark, William Carey. We're going to give you a Danish passport. You go ahead and preach whatever you think God wants you to preach, and if they come to arrest you, wave your Danish passport in their faces. It'll be a perfect shield for you." And it worked. And when William Carey began to speak out against sati, he found there were a few Hindu intellectuals who agreed with him, but they apparently were afraid to say anything until he, the bold foreigner, took the lead. They added their voices to his, and William wrote letters to his supporting churches back in England. Christians became aware of the callousness of the British East India Company in failing to intervene in matters like that. And so letters were written to the British Parliament. Soon the Parliament became aware of a rising groundswell of public opinion, and they sent an order out to the British East India Company saying, "Make sati illegal immediately." And they did. And they also said, "Be nice to this fellow named William Carey. He's got a lot of friends back here." Radical Hindus resented the intervention of the British government in making sati illegal. And they said, wait till we become independent from British rule, we'll make that custom legal again. India did become independent from British rule in the 1940s, and radical Hindus have been pressuring the independent government ever since to make sati legal. Thus far, they have not capitulated to the pressure. It is still officially illegal, though I'm told it still may happen at times where there are no police, or they've been bribed, or they just don't care. But you can be sure tens of millions of women in India, the world's second most populous nation, owe the extension of their lives beyond the death of their husbands as the goodness of God at last reached India in this special way through William Carey. But there are other problems. The problem of caste. The original inhabitants of India, I'm told, were the Dravidian race. Later, a different race, the Aryan race, invaded India from the north, and the Aryan invaders set themselves up as high caste Hindus, relegating the Dravidian population to be the low caste. And the lowest of the low are called Dalits. That is the caste of the untouchables. Hindu priests warn Dravidians of the lowest level of the caste system. You must take care that you never touch the person of an Aryan. Your touch is defiling. They're even warned you must take care that not even so much as your shadow touches the skin of an Aryan person. And it's an occupational prison system without walls. I have a friend born in India in the street sweeper caste. If he stayed in India, all the society would allow him to do is sweep streets all his life. In Southern California, he became a professor of accounting at USC and a Christian. There's a latrine cleaner caste and a rat catcher caste and a gravel chipper caste, and people are locked in this occupational prison system without walls. And that's not saying anything about idolatry on an incredibly massive scale in the Hindu religion. It did not seem likely to William Carey and others who followed the trail he blazed out to India beginning in the late 1700s, they could expect to find anything in the context of Hinduism that might serve as a cultural compass foreshadowing the redemption revealed with the advent of the Lord. But as William Carey and others learned language after language of the Indian subcontinent, eventually they learned a language called Sanskrit. Sanskrit is to India what Latin is to Western civilization, a language that is no longer spoken in the street, but it has a significant body of literature preserved in it. And scholars learned to read the Sanskrit literature, and a major part of that literature is called the Vedas. The oldest Vedic writings were written as long ago as 3,500 years. Some things may have been written as much as 4,000 years ago. Reading the ancient Vedic literature, missionaries began to discover things written by Job-like persons, things that are of a much purer character than the later Vedic writings, which show the advent of an increasingly massive idolatrous system and caste and widow burning, etc. But in those older Vedic writings, they found prophecies, including this, a prophecy that said, somewhere in the world there's an upside down tree. Now, what can cause a tree to be upside down besides a hurricane or a tornado or a bulldozer? This is a tree that is upside down because it is rooted in heaven. And it grows down toward the earth instead of up from the earth. It spreads its branches out above the earth in every possible direction, yielding fruit for all mankind. It goes on to say that the trunk of the upside down tree will be gashed. And the sap that bleeds from the wound in the side of the upside down tree is for the healing of mankind. Nourishing fruit from the branches, healing sap from the wound in the side of a tree rooted in heaven. That's a very strange metaphor, don't you agree? In spite of its strangeness, does it remind you of someone you know and love? Think of the privilege of enabling a Hindu man or woman created in the image of God to understand the significance of that ancient metaphor. A man told me he and his wife were on vacation in India, went into a gift shop, saw a huge tapestry hanging on the wall, upside down tree. He was whispering to his wife, "Should I tell him somebody hung it upside down?" She said, "No, no, it's probably supposed to be that way." And I, as a child, saw a tapestry like that. We visited the home of a man who had served with the British Army in India. And after he retired, immigrated to Canada, brought some memorabilia from India. And here was a huge tapestry with an upside down tree. It mystified me as a child. Many decades later, I learned that there's more than just the fact that it's upside down. Well, people are turning to the Lord in India. And where do you suppose the greatest response would be? Among the Aryan high caste Hindus on their pedestal of privilege, or among the Dalits, the lowest of low of the Dravidian race? That's where the greatest response is happening. Dalits are learning through the gospel of Jesus Christ that they are created in whose image? In the image of God. And who cared enough to die to atone for their sin? God himself incarnate in the person of our Lord. Does that sound like good news to them? And every now and then a high caste Aryan Hindu also believes in Jesus. And what does that mean for him or her? The high caste person who becomes a Christian tumbles down the social scale even lower than the Dalits, being defined as an outcast with absolute zero recognition. It's said that several hundred house churches are opening the doors for the first time every month across India as more and more Dalits are discovering who Jesus is. Now let's come a little further forward in time from the 1790s to 1807. We're in China now. A British ship is docking. One lone Britisher is disembarking in a port city. His name is Robert Morrison. He's there to be a witness for Jesus Christ in the world's most populous nation. And what chance does he think he has? One man, a team of one, coming up against the opposition of four ancient religions that had thousands of years head start, influencing China: Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and in some areas of China, even Islam was already entrenched. And I'm sure Robert Morrison was tempted to yield to discouragement. That probably happened when he discovered that the ancestors of the Chinese about 4,000 years ago did not sit down and invent a phonetic alphabet of 26 or so symbols like our A to Z. They wanted something more complex than that, and they got it. They invented a writing system that utilizes more than 200 little pictures called radicals that get combined in complex ways to make words. Imagine Robert looking at Chinese writing, shaking his head in dismay, saying, "This reminds me of chicken tracks in the mud." He may have been tempted to complain a little bit to God, saying, "Where were you, Lord, when they invented this 4,000 years ago? Couldn't you have exercised a little more of your marvelous capacity for sovereignty, causing it to come up with something simpler?" But he had no choice. He had to master it. He found a Chinese man who had some knowledge of English and was willing to use his rather minimal knowledge of English to help Robert Morrison crack the code of Chinese grammar and amass vocabulary. Sitting down one morning with his Chinese language helper, Robert gave the man his pen and said, "Please, show me. Which of these symbols do you combine to form the word that means righteous in Chinese?" The Chinese man took Robert Morrison's pen and went swish, 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 swish on a piece of paper and showed him how the Chinese formed that word. Robert saw the man had drawn two of the more than 200 options, two radicals, placing one above the other. The upper symbol was the Chinese symbol for a lamb. Underneath it, another little picture that in Chinese means I, first person singular pronoun. He realized when the Chinese write the word that means righteous, they're actually writing the lamb over me, righteous. He asked his Chinese language helper, "Sir, do you know where is the lamb?" under whom you and I must be found to be righteous in the sight of Shanti, the Lord of Heaven. Chinese man said, no, I don't know where that lamb is. How about you, foreigner, do you know? Enabling Robert Morrison to say to him, oh, do I have good news for you and for your people? And Robert Morrison said to himself that there's one spiritually significant encoded message in this ancient writing system. There may be others. I must press on with my study. See what else is awaiting recognition here. And day after day, he began to discover dozens and eventually more than 100 Chinese words that had spiritually significant messages encoded. For example, the Chinese word for a ship requires you to draw something resembling the shape of the hull of a ship. But it doesn't mean ship until you specify the precise number of people sailing in the ship. Write any other number than the one I'm about to mention, you would lose one mark in the Chinese language exam. And the number is 8 people sailing in a ship. I wonder why the ancestors of the Chinese 4,000 years ago thought that 8 people sailing in a ship was somehow significant. According to Genesis, what was the first ship that ever floated? The ark. And how many people were delivered from the flood in the ark? 8 personas, 8 people in the ship. And the Chinese word for covet, desiring something that doesn't belong to you, requires you to draw 2 trees and a woman standing between 2 trees, making some kind of a choice between 2 trees. What could that possibly have to do with coveting? The Chinese word for come, just the verb come, is more complex. To begin, you draw the symbol for a tree at the center, and it's a tree shaped like a cross. The Chinese symbol for a man is like our letter Y turned upside down. An upside down Y. Superimposed over the symbol of a tree. A man suspended on a tree. Another part of it means mankind. And the meaning of this combination of pictures is the verb come. It reads like an encoded message. Mankind come to the man who hung on a tree. Robert Morrison discovering more than 100 significant combinations of symbols like this, must have said, Lord, I take it back. I think your sovereignty was manifested. And he must have felt as privileged as a Joseph interpreting a Pharaoh's dream in Egypt, or as privileged as a Daniel interpreting a Nebuchadnezzar's night vision in Babylon. He was the only man in the world's most populous nation with eyes to see the significance of those Chinese words. And he began to loosen little arrows on more than 100 uniquely Chinese cultural compasses so that they could point Chinese people to Jesus. Initially, there were many who opposed him, calling him a foreign devil and his teaching foreign devil's teaching. But gradually, he began to get the attention of more and more Chinese people. They began to say, listen to him. He is demonstrating that somehow our own ancestors anticipated the teaching that would one day be brought to our nation. And some began to turn to the Lord. And Robert wrote letters to his supporting churches back in England. Letters that took about 6 months to get there and 6 months for an answer to come back. Hopefully with a little support in the envelope. And as his letters were being read in front of congregations of Christians, people were impressed and began to say, that's incredible what's happening out there in China, and along with what's already happening in India via William Carey and others. Then they began to say, who was that fellow out in China? Robert Morrison, never heard of him. And Christians began to ask, how many others did we send out there with him? And the elders who commissioned Robert to go to China rather sheepishly said, actually, we sent only him. We almost weren't persuaded it would be worthwhile. But he kind of kept pressuring us, so we said, okay, apparently it is working out. Christians began to say we should feel ashamed of ourselves sending only one man on so great a mission. Are there others willing to follow the trail he's blazed out there? If there are, let's commission them as well. And there are others willing to follow Robert Morrison to China. Some of them came more famous than him. How many of you had ever heard of the name of Robert Morrison before I said his name in this service? Raise your hands, please. Very few. That's about the average. How many have heard of Hudson Taylor and Maria? Oh, look at that now. They weren't the pioneers. They weren't the trailblazers. Robert Morrison was. But anyway, as more and more people took the gospel to many more other parts of China, the harvest began to grow until by 1949, when the communists took control of China, there were believed to be about 1 million Christians. Using the word Christian in a somewhat demographic sense, but there were hundreds of thousands of true believers among them. And the Chinese Communist government, in the process of seeking to impose atheism upon a very religious nation, slaughtered millions of people just because they were religious. And that included an estimated 500,000 Christians, reducing the number of Christians from 1949 to the early 1950s down to about 500,000. And they warned the surviving Christians, unless you abandon your commitment to Christianity, you cannot be employed by the government. You cannot be a teacher in any school. And your children cannot receive public education. They warned Christians, if you remain stubborn and clinging to the Christian faith, you can only be grave diggers or garbage collectors or tillers of the fields in the communes, nothing more. And they confiscated all the Christian churches in China, changed them into communist warehouses, confiscated Christian schools, changed them into schools to teach communist atheism, expelled all the missionaries from the nation. And there was grave concern that the power of communism, its darkness, would suppress and perhaps eradicate Christian faith from China. But although another 200,000 of the estimated 500,000 Christians who were subjected to that oppression capitulated the pressure and gave up, there remained about 300,000 Chinese Christians who were resolute in their faith. And the communists knew they were there. They appointed a committee, I heard about decades ago, in Beijing, the capital city. The committee was appointed to find some way to discourage the faith of the remaining Christians without the expense of imprisoning them and having to feed them, or killing them and having to bury them. The committee met, and one member claimed to be an authority in Christianity. He said, "I've discovered that Christianity is a religion that depends upon meetings. It's only as Christians meet together and meet together and meet together and sing hymns together and pray together and quote their scriptures together that their faith is kept strong through the mutual encouragement of Christian meetings. So we have a simple solution. We'll send out an order. If a dozen Christians are found in any one commune, we'll require that just one Christian be left there or one nuclear family. We'll scatter the others to other communes where there are no Christians. So Christians will not be able to find other Christians to have mutual encouragement meetings. And instead of Christian meetings in every commune, there will be obligatory attendance, Christians included, to attend meetings to hear the reading of the thoughts of Mao Zedong, the great communist leader, from the Little Red Book. Soon the teachings of Mao will replace the teachings of Jesus. Even in the hearts and minds of these resolute Christians, if we can just weaken their faith by denying them the privilege of fellowship with other Christians." "Thank you," said the other members. "Wouldn't have thought of an ingenious solution like that." So the order went out. And as a result, the communist government of China, completely at its own expense, became the most efficient missionary sending organization in 2,000 years of church history. And the Christians, they scattered as thinly as possible. Though the entire commune system did, of course, suffer from loneliness and heartache, as dear friends, even relatives, were separated from each other, perhaps never to meet again in this world. But how did they solve their loneliness problem besides having fellowship with the Lord? They began to befriend other Chinese people around them. They became noted as people who radiated joy in spite of threats against their well-being by their own government. They were honest and people of integrity. So more and more Chinese people were drawn to them and learned what it was that made them such joyous folk. As a result, the number of Christians in China began to grow exponentially. That's not just growth like a straight line on a graph, but an upward swooping line. And it is now believed, in these years of this new century, the number of Christians in China has grown to more than 100 million. It is estimated the number of Christians in China is increasing at an average daily net gain of 30,000 new believers per day. And The communist government of China is scratching its noggin saying, somehow we made a mistake here. And it's too late to undo it. There are so many Christians, we just have to show them a little bit of grudging goodwill. So as a means of demonstrating a minor goodwill to the Christians, they've begun to give some of those warehouses back to the Christians. They gladly accept them back and refurbish them as the churches they were originally. And so many believers and other curious people throng to attend those reopened churches in cities of China. They've had to establish a rule for some churches in China, a rule that says, you are not permitted to attend this church two Sundays in a row. If you do, you will be stealing standing room only from other people that need to hear the word of God. Elsewhere in the world, pastors are frequently heard to say, I didn't see you in church last Sunday. In China, some pastors are more like birds of wait, didn't I see you in church last Sunday? Give your pastors that problem. They'll love you for it, I think. Right? So was it very worthwhile for William Carey to blaze the trail to India and Robert Morrison to blaze the trail to China? Think of what was hanging in the balance. For someone to break the ice, stick his toe in the water, and demonstrate there are things that can be done and must be done. All right, so India and China, major societies, developed cultures. But what about remote tribes hidden away in jungles, especially if they're practicing cannibalism and headhunting, and Stone Age people don't even have steel tools? Surely you couldn't expect to find anything in that kind of a culture that would be there to point men and women to Jesus in a unique way, could you? Or could you? 1962. My first wife, Carol Joy, and I, with our firstborn baby son, little Stephen, sailed across the Pacific Ocean to Australia, disembarked and turned right, heading north from Australia to an island called New Guinea. And Pastor Lee described it as very long. Well, how long is very long? 2,500 kilometers long, that's how long. And it's 750 kilometers wide at the widest, shaped like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Head is at the western end with open jaws, narrow neck, hulking body, a tail several hundred miles long, tapering on the western edge of the Pacific. And New Guinea is a land where one out of seven languages on earth is spoken, a total of 1,000 languages. And when we arrived under a mission, it used to be called Regions Beyond Missionary Union, now World Team. Everyone please say World Team. Now please say worldteam.org. Look us up on the web. Mission that began back in 1873 in London, England. That means it's the second oldest interdenominational church planting faith mission still in existence. Second only to China Inland Mission, now called Overseas Missions Fellowship, which I'm sure is well represented here. Well, when we arrived, all our colleagues were working in the mountains, a mile above sea level. And that's where you can grow vegetables, just like you can grow here. Vegetables that won't grow at sea level in the tropics. And there wasn't even any malaria yet in the mountains. Mosquitoes hadn't gotten there. Once airstrips were open and airplanes began flying in, mosquitoes hitched a ride. And eventually, malaria got in through those hitchhikers. But it was a healthy place, and the tribes in the mountains had already begun to respond to the gospel. So our colleague said, welcome, Don and Carol. There's lots of work to be done here among the mountain tribes, but we do need to let you know a new tribe has been discovered in the swamps at sea level, way to the south, swamps drenched with 7 meters of rainfall a year, a tribe called the Sawi. They are still practicing cannibalism and headhunting. They've never heard of judges, jails, police, or law courts. And we don't know if they'll welcome the missionary to dinner or make him dinner. You don't have to go there. It's in our World Team area responsibility, but, you know, it doesn't have to be you and Carol. But we just need to let you know it is an option. So I was praying, Lord, I want to serve you where you want us to serve you. And I am, by hobby, a mountain climber. I still am. In the USA, where I live now, every summer I go to Colorado and day hike 4,500 meter peaks. That's 14,000 feet plus. And I bagged 30 of them. And so I love climbing mountains. And the mountains of Guinea rise even as much as 2,000 feet higher than anything in the USA except Alaska. And so everybody thought, oh, he's going to want to serve among the mountain tribes, so on his days off, he can climb. But the Lord was saying, Don, I want you to go to that newly discovered tribe in the swamps, the Sawi. They are the people I've prepared for you to bear witness among for me. I know they're cannibals. I know they're headhunters. Don't worry about that, Don. I've taken care of everything. They will welcome you. I said, Lord, I'm willing to go. But my wife, Carol, is a pastor's daughter from Cincinnati, Ohio. She's been on a camping trip or two. So if you want us to go, man and wife and baby son, Stephen, less than a year old, to live among those cannibals in that swamp, please give assurance to my wife from the Holy Spirit so that she'll know it's your calling, not just her husband, wanting to go on a wild adventure, dragging her and little baby Stephen along. And God did that. Carol said, Don, I keep thinking about the Sawi people all day. I fall asleep thinking about them. And I wake up and pray for them. Do you think God might want us to go there? And I said, yes, I think so. So we prayed and received assurance from God it was his will. And we said to our colleagues, we want to go to the Sawi. Everybody said two or three times, are you sure? Yeah, we're sure. So we went down. I left Carol and Stephen in a safe place. Went in to test the attitudes of the Sawi people and found out for a couple of years or so, they'd begun hearing positive reports about tall, pale, sickly-looking beings called Tuans. That means European types. And all the reports about Tuans were positive. They looked so strange. But they never hurt anyone. And wherever they go, they bring opat, which means medicine, and garam, which means salt. The tribes in New Guinea crave salt like you wouldn't believe. They don't have a supply of it. And they said, Tuans bring steel axes to replace stone tools. If you ever tried to chop down a tree with a stone axe, you would quickly discover even the dullest steel axe is a vast technological improvement over the sharpest stone axe. And things like machetes and nylon fish line and fish hooks and soap. Soap is something, if you're an adult, you're, let's say, 30 years old, and soap has never touched your skin. You have washed yourself with water, but that doesn't get everything off. There's still skin grease there to some extent if you just use water. Use soap and water, and you feel genuinely clean. And it's a shock to the system when it first happens. It becomes an addictive thing. You just got to have soap once you've experienced that first bath. And Tuans were providers of these things. So the Sawi had been saying wistfully to other tribes that live a little closer to civilization, are there any spare Tuans around? We think we'd like to welcome one. Only have the other tribes say, nastily, a Tuan live among you. Who do you think you are? Don't you realize these Tuans are a scarce commodity? It's not enough for every tribe to have one, let alone every village. And they're choosy about where they live and who they would choose to live among. And you saw we are the worst of all the tribes. Don't get your hopes up. You'll never be favored by the presence of one of these rare beings. Hearing these insulting comments from their enemies, the Sawi people were saying, perhaps they're right. I guess we can't claim to be anyone special. But they also said, just in case, someday, somewhere, there is a Tuan who finds out that we live here and decides he wants to come and reside among us. And if he doesn't allow the anti-Sawi propaganda of our enemies to turn him away from us, when we find out that Tuan has chosen us, we'll let him know in no uncertain terms, we choose him. He'll be our Tuan. We'll be his tribe. Guess which sort of a bloke you're looking at here. I'm a Tuan. My wife, Carol Joy, a Nyonya, a female Tuan. Even had a little baby Tuan, little Stephen. So when I used gestures, I didn't know their language, of course, indicating I wanted to help to build a little house and a little bit of high ground, they got the message. They began shouting for joy. And I handed out some steel tools. I went out and cut poles and helped me build a little 400-square-foot jungle home under a thatch roof. No glass in the windows, just green plastic fly screen. No sawn timber, just split palm bark for a floor. You get used to walking on the ripples and waves and ridges.
And it looked like a little matchbox beneath the towering jungle trees around it, because it looked like a little matchbox and had a thatch roof. I nicknamed it our thatch box. And there'll be a photograph of it out on the book table in the alley out there after the meeting. Well, the house was finished. I thanked them for helping me build it and use more sign language to indicate I was going to fetch my family and would return in 3 days with them to reside among them in the little house they kindly helped me build. They nodded, seemed to understand, left them. Next, 3 days later, Carol and I made a 10-hour journey in a wobbly 30-foot-long dugout canoe, a tree trunk hollowed out in the shape of a craft, and three paddlers in the front, three paddlers in the back, a little shade roof for Carol and Steve in the middle. And it took 10 hours as they threaded that long canoe like a needle through the waterways of the swamp, burst out into the headwaters of a river called the Cronkel, and paddled downstream with the flow of the water. As the sun was setting, we came around the last bend of the river, and I saw the silhouette of the roof of the little thatch box against the glowing sky, and what looked like 400 people massed on the riverbank waiting to see if the Tuan would keep his promise and return with his family. We got closer, and I saw all the men had war paint on and were holding weapons. I thought, what's the meaning of the weapons and the war paint? Is this a welcoming party or something else? Are we invited to dinner or to be dinner? It was too late to think of retreating. We're already within range of the weapons. I didn't say anything to Carol. I just let her think they always looked that way. Because if they intended to kill us, hey, all we could do is hope it would be over as quickly, as painlessly as possible. But the canoe slid up on the mud at the feet of that armed host. Three paddlers in the front step off onto the shore, make way for us to climb up out of the canoe. I carried Stephen and led Carol behind me, and we walked up out of the canoe right into the midst of that armed host. They closed in all around us so tightly we could hardly move, and their eyes were gleaming with excitement. But no one was uttering the greeting. No one said, Konohari, that's the greeting. I thought, why are they so silent? They must be waiting for a signal. A signal for what? They were waiting for a signal, and someone shouted it, Isa! At that signal, y'all began leaping in the air, shouting for joy and pounding on their drums. And they began chanting and dancing around us, edging us further and further away from the river, closer and closer to the front steps, a little thatch box, about 80 meters away. And I thought, how's Carol taking this? I looked at her. She was smiling at the people. She must have thought, this is how they welcome you. You've got to expect it's going to be different. It was okay. Little Stephen used to cry if the wind caused the door to slam anywhere nearby. I thought, how will he react to the thunder of the drums, the leaping and shouting of all these men? Here he was, nearly jumping out of my arms, reaching to grab white cockatoo feathers and golden bird of paradise plumes and dog fang necklaces and pig tusk bracelets that the dancers were wearing. He had never had so many interesting things within reach of his little hands. He was at peace, and so was I. It was as if we were being baptized again, not with water this time, but with Sawi humanity. As if we're standing at the eye of a hurricane of people. And it took a few minutes. We reached the front steps leading up to the porch of the little thatch box. They all stopped. A tumult of chanting motioned to us to climb the steps. We did. Went inside, closed the door. As soon as the door closed behind us, they began pounding on the drums again, danced around the house all night long. And all the next day. And all the second night and second day and third night. Oh, what a welcome. And of course, I couldn't even wait till that tumultuous welcome was finished. Very next morning, I said to Carol, I've got to get started learning their language. Could I go to a corner bookstore and purchase a published grammar and a published dictionary to learn Sawi? Now, they spoke a language for which no one had ever even invented an alphabet, let alone published language study materials. And I did not even have a bilingual language instructor like Robert Morrison at least had in China. How do you learn a language in a situation like that? I'll tell you what you have to do. You have to resort to the finger-pointing method. I mean, you stand among the people and start pointing at things, hoping the people will understand you, want them to give you a word in their language for whatever you point at. Well, I began by pointing at a man. They looked at me curiously. One of them said, Didig. I wrote down, Didig means man. Then I pointed at a woman and they said, Didig. I thought, okay, perhaps it means person without regard to gender. So I crossed out man and wrote person. Then I pointed at a dog and they said, Didig. I pointed at a house, a tree, a canoe, a paddle, a river. No matter what I pointed at, they kept saying, Didig, 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 Didig. But then I was saying, Lord, have you led me halfway around the world to learn a language that has only one word? At length, I realized what Didig meant. Finger. It is not solely body language to point with one finger, not unless you're placing a curse upon someone or something. Thank God they were giving their tuan the benefit of the doubt that he wasn't placing curses on them. If they'd drawn that conclusion, I wouldn't be here to tell you about it. And they were probably muttering, this tuan is so dense. He keeps holding up his finger. We keep telling the word for finger. He keeps asking us to repeat it. Do we have to stand here all day saying nothing but finger, 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 finger? What's the point? We're all tuans as dense as this one that we get the dumbest one that was left over. Later I found I had to learn to point with my lips. In our culture, you know what that's asking for? This was just the beginning of our cross-cultural communication odyssey. Among 3,000 Sawi people divided into 18 villages in about 1,200 square miles of dense jungle. Well, I eventually became fluent enough to begin teaching. And I explained about God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, coining a name for him in Sawi, Mialkadon, the greatest good spirit, and Haudnabal, the father in the sky. I described how God created man in his image for fellowship with him, for a love relationship, which was shattered by the fall. Man was estranged and from God and condemned by God's law. But God did not give up on mankind. He commissioned his own son to become a human, born among men, growing up among the Jewish people in a faraway place, working miracles, gathering his disciples, training them to be his messengers to the world. But I described how one of Jesus' chosen disciples, Judas, turned against him after some 3 years of close friendship and betrayed him to his worst enemies to be led away and slain, and betrayed him with a kiss. They were paying unusually close attention to this story of a betrayal. Sawi word for it is tare. And when I described Judas's method of using a kiss to consummate his betrayal of his victim, they burst forth cheering for Judas, saying, Don, that man named Judas is the sort of man we call a tare duan, a master of treachery. Tell us more about Judas. He's the sort of man any one of us would be proud to promise a daughter to in marriage. What he did, the one called Jesus, kissing him in order to betray him, that's what we call tui asanaiman, using gestures of friendship merely to fatten a victim for an unsuspected slaughter. That was not the response this young missionary was expecting. I sat among them, chilled to realize they were a culture that honored treachery as a kind of national sport. And they esteemed men who were very skilled in it, men who could welcome someone from a different tribe or a faraway clan as a guest on repeated visits. They knew they could kill him on the first visit, but that would be something, not something special. But let him come 4, 5, 6 times and feel royally welcome till he's totally feels secure as an ambassador from his village to this one. And then he comes one more time and they pass the signal from eyebrow to eyebrow. Men arm themselves and circle the guests seated in the manhouse feasting on toasted betel grubs or sago. He looks up as he feels the darkness closing in and sees the eyes of his host riveted upon his countenance, he hears one of them say, "Tuya asanai makaidiva, we have been fattening you with friendship for this day of slaughter." After which they kill him and cannibalize him. So, I prayed, "Lord, I need a gift of wisdom here. You all know what the Bible says, if any man lack wisdom, let him take a further course in seminary." What is it urged? First and foremost, ask of God. And I was asking. And I sensed that God had called us there. And this idealization of treachery was like, in computer terminology, a firewall preventing the significance of the gospel getting through to the hearts and minds of the people. How could it be penetrated? To make matters worse, warfare broke out because three entire Sawi villages wanted to live close to the Tuan, which we thought was great. That gave us hundreds more people that my wife Carol could minister to with medicine, deliver babies that would have died. And one out of 10 Sawi people suffered from a dreadful disease called Yaws, which is similar to leprosy. It just eats away at the flesh and keeps spreading. And it's transmitted by flies. And if a woman has Yaws, no man would ever want to marry her. If a man had Yaws, everyone would sleep at a distance from him because of the stench from the dripping sores. It's a horrible disease, but it's different from leprosy in that it can be cured with just one shot of the right kind of penicillin called Almepen. The Dutch government, which hadn't yet left that part of New Guinea, provided us with supplies of medicine, including Almepen. Within 2.5 years, my wife eradicated Yaws from the entire Sawi tribe and the nearer parts of neighboring tribes. They called her the woman who makes all the villages well. And she would also be teaching Sawi women the gospel in her special meetings with them. But two of the three villages that relocated to live close to us had unsettled grudges which they were unable to overlook. And insults were shouted, arrows began to flash through the air, and we found ourselves living in the midst of war, day after day. Men were wounded right outside our house. And I wanted to be a peacemaker, of course, standing on the edge of these raging battles, pleading, "Please stop fighting, it's not nice." I wanted to be more eloquent than that, but I was still in the early stages of learning their language. Some days I had a measure of success in interrupting the momentum of the battles. But I thought, hey, if I shout, "Stop fighting," when a guy turns to look at me, when he should be watching to see an arrow coming straight at him, he might be killed because I distracted him. So it was a dreadful situation. And I kept urging them to make peace, and they kept saying something that it took me a while to understand. Finally, I understood what they were saying. "You keep asking us to make peace as if that should be an easy thing to do. No doubt it's easy for you too. As far as we know, you never have anything more than a minor disagreement. So a handshake is enough for people like you, but not for us. Making peace is not the easy thing you seem to think it should be. You don't realize what you're asking." When I discovered their idealization of treachery, I said to myself, aha. Now I know why they say it's not easy to make peace. Because making peace requires some basis for mutual trust. How can there be mutual trust when each side in the conflict is well aware that an offer of peace from the enemy might be a setup for greater slaughter? I actually came to the conclusion that God had commissioned us to serve him in the midst of a culture that had left itself devoid of any mechanism for making peace, which meant they were locked on a treadmill of vengeance and counter-vengeance without end. And I thought, now I think I know why there's less than 3,000 of them, even though they've existed as a separate culture for no doubt thousands of years. Why aren't there millions of them? They've been killing each other. They've been unable to make peace. And the victim levels have been astronomical in relation to the population. I'm glad to tell you, I soon discovered I was wrong. Despite the idealization of treachery, the Sawi people did have a way of making peace. If a father in one of two warring villages deeply, genuinely wanted to make peace, he could do so. Only if he was willing to make a sacrifice so great that everyone in both communities would know. A man who brings himself to make that great a sacrifice is obviously sincere. That's a sacrifice an insincere man could not summon the resolve for. He had to be willing to take a little baby boy, his little son, and give his son as a peace child irrevocably to an enemy father. And the child that he gave would be raised in that other village. He and his wife who brought that child into the world might never see that child again unless from a distance. And as long as the child they gave remained alive in that other village, the peace would be secured, because no one would be so evil as to make that great a sacrifice invalid by renewing hostilities again later. No one would even speak anything insulting to anyone from the other community. They were bound to honor each other because of a peace child given. In living Sawi memory, the father who came to that level of sacrifice, gave a son, had always been a father blessed with several children. But something was to happen that day that would startle even the Sawi, because a father named Kayo in one of the two warring villages walked down the row of longhouses of his community looking to see if any father blessed with several children could bring himself to give one as a peace child. One after another, they sadly shook their heads. They couldn't bring themselves to give up a child. So Kayo said, "Then it's up to me." He and his wife had been married for years and were blessed with only one baby, a little baby boy named Byakadon, a little lad about the same age as our own firstborn son, Stephen. Kayo picked up little Stephen after his wife had left the longhouse. He knew her maternal instinct would not allow her to consent. It had to be done in a way that would break her heart. But he so appreciated the fact that Carol and I had chosen to live among the Sawi and were saving lives with medicine virtually every day and making steel axes and other things that they really wanted and needed available to them. He couldn't bear to see the senseless violence of his people drive the Tuan and the Nyonya away to another part, because I had warned them, if this violence doesn't end, I will have to relocate. So these two villages that used to fight very infrequently because they lived a long way apart, now they're fighting frequently because we brought them close together, and that means they fight each other more frequently. Much more blood is being shed, so I should move away for your own good. They didn't want us to go. Kayo could not bear to see that happen. Out of concern for the well-being of both communities and all the other villages of the tribe, he ran with little Byakadon in his arms out of his village, past our home, heading toward the enemy community. People in both villages saw what he was doing, began shouting encouragement to him. His wife, hearing the commotion, turned and saw her husband running with her baby toward the enemy village, and she screamed in anguish, ran after him but couldn't overtake him. When she saw him enter the outskirts of the enemy village, she lost all strength in her knees, collapsed in the mud, wailing, "My child, my child, my child." She knew she would never get to hold little Byakadon to her own breast again. He would be nursed and raised by another man's wife in the other village. I saw Kayo enter the enemy village with no weapons for self-defense and no reinforcements. I said to a Sawi man standing near me, is it possible they'll take advantage of him and kill him and maybe kill the baby he holds in his arms? That Sawi man said, "No, Don, no, no. Didn't anyone tell you? We Sawi never slay a man who approaches us with a baby in his arms." I suddenly realized a child in a man's arms in Sawi culture is the equivalent of a white flag of truce in ours. They have no cloth of, in those days, had no cloth of any color. So a baby served the purpose. But Caio carried his baby in his arms, not to as a shield for himself among enemies, but to make enemies friends. He chose an enemy father and placed his only son in that father's arms and said, Nohoni no somaidap go ke finikate taro makamai. I'm giving my son, my only son, to you as a peace child. And the man honored to be chosen as the foster father of a peace child. And realizing that what he held in his arms was another man's only son, responded with deep emotion, Kayo gonego somaidap niki ke fina rainde es. You've given your only son to us. We are reconciled. It is enough. He pledged himself to be the advocate for peace between his community and Caio's community. He presented the peace child to all the people of that village, and I saw them thronging around, reaching out one after another, touching the little boy on the chest and shouting these words of pledge. Ini tim ke kananai arkivi. I received this child as a basis for peace. And everyone touched the peace child. No one refused. And everyone was committed to a covenant of peace. Then they began to celebrate peace. And by the way, a father in that enemy village, deeply moved by Caio's sacrifice of an only son, gave one of his several children to Caio, that he might at least have another woman's baby to place in the arms of his heartbroken wife, that she might find some peace. And as the peace was being celebrated, I said to myself, what is this? A father giving a son, an only son at that, to his enemies for the purpose of reconciliation. Why is there something familiar about this? And suddenly it struck me like a sledgehammer of insight. With a gasp, I said, oh my God, I was asking you to give me a gift of wisdom. And look what you have had prepared here. This has your fingerprints on it, Lord. They didn't get this custom from the evil one. It's from you. It's here to serve your purpose. And nothing serves your purpose by mere chance. Lord, you are far too sovereign ever to be lucky. So I see it is your purpose. And I'm going to do my part. I'm going to find all the abstract nouns and verbs the Sawi people used to explain the deep meaning of the peace child sacrifice. And I'm going to learn to conjugate those verbs through all the tenses of the indicative mood, all the forms of the subjunctive mood of the verb, all the forms of the imperative mood of the verb. And I will proclaim Jesus as the Tarotim Kodon, the greatest peace child given by Navokodon, the greatest father, to establish the Torkon Achkodon, the greatest peace between God and man, between man and his fellow man. It took me 3 months more of intensive language study. And then I climbed up into the same longhouse where the warriors of Hainan village had chortled over Judas's betrayal of Jesus with a kiss. And I began to reason with them about Jesus as a peace child. They listened in village after village with increasing interest. I was making more sense among them from that day forward than I'd made before. They began responding to my teaching about Jesus as a peace child with perceptive questions, including this one. One Sawi man, sitting in the midst of his peers, said, Don, you are telling us that Jesus is a peace child, but that conflicts with something you told us about him earlier. I said, what is that? He said, you told us that someone named Judas betrayed him with a kiss to be killed. I said, yes, I did tell you that, and I was horrified that you acclaimed the betrayer as a hero. He said, Don, you need to understand, you didn't tell us he betrayed a peace child with that kiss, now did you? If you told us that, no way would we have acclaimed him as a hero. Believe me, Judas's ratings plunged. He was the worst villain Asawi could imagine. And Jesus was unveiled among them as the perfect personal fulfiller of their own uniquely Sawi peace child custom. Jesus became the Lamb of God, as John the Baptist used that metaphor among the Jews. And now he was becoming the peace child, Kodon, the greatest peace child for the Sawi. The more they listened to me, the more I saw them sitting there rubbing their elbows. And I thought, this elbow rubbing, it means something. What is it? Just like if you and I are deep in thought trying to solve a problem, what do? We scratch our noggins or we stroke our chins. If a sower among us saw us, you know, scratching our noggins and stroking our chins, what does this all mean? But there was I asking, what does this elbow rubbing mean? And then I remembered of a group of Salvi men are saying, should we go on a journey or stay home? Should we fight or not fight? They rub their elbows, a sign they are in the throes of making a decision and haven't quite made it yet. I wonder, what is the decision they are contemplating as they rub their elbows, listening to me describe Jesus as the greatest peace child? I found out today a one-eyed Salvi chief named Hato, man who had lost his left eye, been pierced by an arrow in a battle years before, stood up, gazed at me with his one good eye, and said, Don, goni sin pakegu no hawakadun kakin. Don, your words make my liver quiver. I said, why, Hato, my friend? I've been listening to everything you've been telling us about this great peace child, and I, Hato, want to lay my hand on him. How do I lay my hand on Jesus? Do I have to go to a distant village to find him? Laying a hand on the peace child was a way of demonstrating acceptance. I'm glad I found the right words. I responded, Hato, you lay your hand on Jesus, kadon mani, by way of faith. He is present right here with us by his spirit. You and I cannot see him, but he sees us. I led him in prayer. He invited the spirit of God's holy peace child, Jesus, to dwell within his liver, keep him in the way of peace with God and man from the inside. Yes, for the Salvi, the liver is the main thing. The heart is only a pump. And believe me, as cannibals, they know about the internal organs. So that was the beginning of a transformation spreading from village to village as more and more Salvi laid their hands by faith on Jesus, pledging themselves to be at peace with him and God and with each other. And the warfare ended. The villages lived at peace, and they would gather for feasts. People that never would have dared to go to another village lest they walk into a trap of treachery came with confidence and celebrated together and just hugged each other and became not isolated villages but a Christian community. And Hato traveled with me to many different villages. He and I logged about 1,200 miles of jungle travel in the year following his response to the gospel, helping me explain the significance of Jesus in all the Salvi villages. And so the percentage of believers grew. More and more people were baptized, trained Salvi elders to lead the churches that were formed, and translated the New Testament into their language. Trained another missionary couple from Canada, John and Esther Mills, who John began adding parts of the Old Testament to the Salvi New Testament. And the church has grown, increased, and become known amidst the other tribes for honesty because they were noted for not stealing. The Indonesian government selected that place to be a government outpost because it put the government outpost where there were no Christians. It was not very easy to live there. Government officer's wife hangs the clothes out on the line, clothes are stolen off the line. Tools stolen out of the workshop. Children leave toys, sandals in the yard, all stolen. Give them axes to go out and cut poles or bring the poles back and ask to be paid. But where's the axes I loaned to you to cut the poles? Oh, didn't we tell you? We put them all in one canoe and the canoe capsized. They sank in the river, which is not what happened. But lying and thievery were so endemic, they didn't want to move the outpost there. They placed the government outpost in the Salvi domain, saying we're following the footsteps of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so they're at the center of all the people have to come to, which gives them opportunity to witness. And the government officers who are posted to that area do not like living there. They want to be posted to a city, at least a small town, where there's a cinema and a shopping center and a genuine soccer field with goalposts of the right size. And so they count the days till they can be transferred. It's like their time in purgatory before they qualify for a better place. And then they hear that a book has been written, a book called Peace Child, written about this godforsaken swamp. Who would have written a book? Oh, there was a missionary here. Oh, that's why these people don't steal. Okay, And he wrote a book, and it's being read around the world. Uh-oh, we Muslim government officers better not mistreat his friends here, because he's still alive somewhere. If we mistreat his friends and he hears about it, he'll write a sequel and we'll be the villains. So because Peace Child has been translated into the Sawi language along with many others, it has made the Sawi tribe rather famous. And as they leave their tribal area and get jobs in cities and towns and other areas at that eastern end of Indonesia, people find out there's one of those Peace Child people in town. Everybody wants to invite him to lunch, hear more of his story. They get to share the gospel. So the number of Christians has increased to somewhere between 80% and 90% of adults and teenagers. Most of the rest are little babies, too young to indicate their choice to follow the Lord. Carol and I were so grateful that God called us there and enabled us to discover this principle, which I came to name redemptive analogy, or cultural compasses, as I said earlier. And then I was launched into what has become decades of study to see how many different redemptive analogies I could find in other cultures and other parts of the world. And I found that neighbors of the Sawi on the west side, the Azmat, who may have killed and cannibalized the son of Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York State, young Michael Rockefeller, back in 1961. Up to this date, no human skull has been found with fillings in the teeth. But it's thought he may have been killed and cannibalized by the Azmat. But their way of making peace requires children of 5, 6, 7 years of age from two warring communities to wiggle through over a passageway framed in human flesh, squirming over the backs of 12 fathers between the ankles of 12 mothers. And each child who wiggles through that passageway is picked up. If he's a child from village A, he's picked up by people from the enemy village, village B, and rocked like a newborn baby. And then they wash all 12 symbolically reborn children as if washing birth stains from 12 newborn babies. Then the people from village A take the 6 children from village B with them in their canoes for 3 days of feasting and rejoicing in their village, leaving their 6 children to be taken to the opposite village for the same purpose. And after 3 days of feasting and rejoicing, they return all 12 children to their own families. From that time forward, no more war, no more ambush, no more killing, because they regard themselves as one extended family organically linked by these 12 reciprocally reborn children. Their 6 children are reborn into the kinship system of the other village, and their 6 children are reborn into our kinship system. So we're a family now, so we don't kill each other. Peace through a new birth experience. Now, where have you heard of that before? They are better able to be reasoned with about new birth than Nicodemus was. How did Nicodemus respond when Jesus made mention of new birth in John chapter 3? He responded with a naively literal, almost childish objection. How can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter his mother's womb a second time and be born? No, Azmat would ever, ever object that way. Instead, he'd said, what? You and your people have a new birth too? Yes, we do. He will say, is your new birth like ours? To which you respond, there are some similarities and there are some differences. Let me tell you about them. There's no way he will object, hold on, Vishnu, this doesn't make sense. How can a man be born when he's old? The Azmat people, head under cannibals in the jungles of New Guinea, are better prepared to be reasoned with about new birth than Nicodemus, the equivalent of a seminary-trained Jewish teacher of the law. Who would expect that? Found a tribe in New Guinea, wrote a book about them called Lords of the Earth that had places of refuge, reminiscent of Old Testament cities of refuge. And so there's an incredible variety of these things around the world, proving that God, who prepared the gospel for all peoples on earth, has also been working sovereignly to prepare the peoples of the earth for the gospel that he's prepared for them. It's been a two-way preparation. Does that indicate that God is serious about missions? He's prepared them for the gospel and trusted the gospel to us. What do you suppose he wants to do with the message? Warehouse it? Where we live? Obviously not. Ask God to enable you to participate directly or indirectly, one way or another, in the process of commissioning messengers to cross all the as yet uncrossed frontiers, learn all the languages in which the gospel has not yet been proclaimed. Because God wants some, hopefully many, but at least some from every language, nation, people, and tribe. And he's entrusted that mission to us. Let's get on with the task. Thank you. God bless you.